Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Static Mayhem by Edward Aubrey. Narrated by C.S.E. Cooney. Part 1. Anti-Secrecy. Chapter 1. Fire. At the apex of the slow, sparkling curve she drew through the sky, Glimmer exploded. The flash and spray of lights at first resembled a traditional fireworks display, but as the points of luminescence scattered, they each took on new colors and expanded into pinwheels, which themselves detonated into showers of sparks. One spark, close to the center of the explosion, sprouted purple butterfly wings as it expanded. The light grew into human form, visible even from a distance, and even at its tiny size. The pixie did an aerial pirouette and spiraled upward and out of sight. The park lawn erupted into applause. From his folding chair, Harrison Cody took in the faces of his awestruck children. Mitchell clapped furiously, an enormous grin covering his face. Dorothy was more demure, her smile relaxed and her applause enthusiastic. Picnic blankets and chairs filled about half the park. Most of the attendees appeared human, but from a distance it was often impossible to know that for sure. A small party of centaurs sat on the grass nearby. Some hapless worker would no doubt have to shovel up after them the next morning. Harrison glanced behind him at three sets of bleachers, the center one cordoned off with ropes and secret service. At the top sat President Louise Hatfield, with her entourage. Some of the people sitting near her were security detail, but Harrison recognized Claudia de Quiroz, the Brazilian-American teenager who, like him, served as a special agent with a new Chicago security agency. On the president's right sat her fiancé, a woman Harrison had not yet met. The first president of the Republic of New Chicago, Hatfield had shattered the glass ceiling right out of the gate as the nation's first woman president and first openly lesbian president. When there had still been a United States, Louise served in the Senate, and her marriage to a man had been for show. In the wake of the world ending, politics were now, in some ways, of a decidedly different character. Mitchell smacked Harrison's arm and pointed to the sky. Glimmer had returned to the fireworks and shot lights out of her hands to form letters. Harrison split his attention between the show and his adopted daughter in order to track the exact moment when her jaw dropped. That happened on the fifth letter. By the time Glimmer had finished etching Dorothy into the night sky, Dorothy was staring at Harrison with a look of shock.
"I think that's supposed to say surrender," he said casually.
"This was for me?" said Dorothy.
"Happy birthday, big 15-year-old."
Harrison pointed to the sky, where Glimmer had wrapped the word around a three-dimensional image of a cake with 15 candles burning.
"Make a wish."
Dorothy laughed and made a show of blowing at the display, then gasped as the flames on the 15 candles flared and went out. The crowd applauded again, then halted as the cake expanded and exploded in a shower of colors that rapidly fanned out to the horizon. Dorothy stood.
"Get up, you."
She held her hand out. Harrison took it, and she pulled him out of his seat and into a hug.
"Thank you."
"I thought for sure you were going to figure it out," he said. "For a super genius, you're pretty slow sometimes."
She pulled away.
"Yes, well, very well played."
A purple sparkly streak fell out of the sky onto the armrest of Harrison's chair. Glimmer landed there and took off her white visored helmet, shaking out her iridescent silver hair. She wore an olive jumpsuit with Air Force insignia above the left breast pocket zipper. On her right hand, she wore a mitten she had refused to talk about for months. Her feet were bare.
"How did I do?"
"It was beautiful," said Dorothy. "Thank you so much."
"Didn't see it coming?"
Dorothy shook her head.
"Nope."
Glimmer giggled.
Dorothy looked over Harrison's shoulder and nodded in that direction. Claudia had come down from the bleachers and held back at a short distance. By the light of the park's street lamps, the shock of white in her otherwise black hair stood out more than usual. Harrison offered a cordial smile.
"What's up?"
Claudia looked at her feet, then at a point somewhere not quite in the direction of Harrison's eyes.
"I'm supposed to tell you you've got another supply run tomorrow morning, and something about consequences if you leave your communicator at home again. Because, you know, it's like your job."
She looked past him and waved.
"Hey, Dottie, happy birthday."
"Thanks," said Dorothy.
Neither girl made further attempts to engage. Claudia had been Dorothy's first true friend when they arrived in New Chicago the previous November, and had also been partly responsible for Harrison being arrested. The three of them did not find balance an easy thing to achieve in social settings.
"Yeah, anyway," said Claudia, "Alec needs you to report at 5 o'clock.
"Oh, for God's sake," said Harrison. "I was about to take the kids for ice cream."
Claudia shrugged.
"How much sleep you get is between you and Alec."
"Hey," said Glimmer, "I've got this. If you want to get some shut-eye, I'll get the kids home, okay?"
"I need you to get them up tomorrow, too,"
he said to the pixie. No one voiced questions about a 9-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl being parented by a 12-inch-tall woman with butterfly wings, one of the least odd things about the new rhythm they had all found in their lives.
"Make sure Mitchell eats breakfast."
Glimmer saluted.
"Aye, aye, Cap'n."
Dorothy hugged him again. He kissed her on the forehead.
"Happy birthday, kiddo."
"Travel safely," she said.
Harrison crouched to get a hug from Mitchell as well, then headed back to their apartment, alone.
Chapter 2 Vault. Through the small window of the transport, random scenery scrolled by. Harrison rode in silence, surrounded by a dozen agents, most of whose names he did not know. A few of them engaged in occasional quiet discussion, but Harrison kept to himself, and they all seemed content to let him do so. The ride from HQ took nearly 2 hours. They traveled over uneven terrain, but inside the cabin of the transport, only the most severe bumps translated into discomfort, and even then only barely.
"That's it, up ahead," said the driver.
The agent sitting next to Harrison stood and made his way through the narrow compartment to the front. He leaned over the driver's seat and looked out the windshield, effectively blocking Harrison's view of their target.
"Nice. Pull us up alongside on the left there. Leave us about a 20-foot berth."
"No problem."
The driver pulled the wheel to the left. Less than a minute later, the vehicle came to a halt. Its engine noise went from quiet to silent.
"Car, Milton, you're with me," said the standing agent. "I want the rest of you scouting the grounds."
All the remaining agents unbuckled seatbelts, adjusted field gear, and filed out the rear hatch. Carr and Milton, a man and a woman, though Harrison could not recall which, exited through the front door. Harrison undid his seat restraint.
"Sit tight, Cody."
The lead agent put his hand on Harrison's shoulder. Slender, blonde, and probably younger than Harrison. His name badge read Coggins. Harrison had met him at least once before this mission, but had exchanged fewer than 24 words with him. The transport emptied out, apart from the driver. Coggins followed his two agents out the front exit. Harrison got up and moved forward to look out the windshield. Somewhere in the wilderness that had once been the state of Illinois, they had arrived at an opulent mansion surrounded by palm trees. Its outward appearance offered familiar 20th-century architecture. That meant nothing. The interior was as likely to include future technology as anything recognizable. Or it could easily contain items of a magical nature, objects whose properties would have been literally impossible prior to May 30th, 2004, when everything changed. For that reason,
Either Carr or Milton would have to be an agent who specialized in the esoteric. If there were artifacts with supernatural qualities to be found within, the agency had methods to detect them, and the means to contain and retrieve them. Through the front window, most of the team visibly patrolled the environs of the house. One would occasionally crouch down to inspect something, but none indicated remarkable discoveries. Harrison watched this activity quietly. The driver, still in his seat, divided his attention among the monitors in front of him, the view from the window, and a manual on his lap. Neither of them attempted to converse. Harrison's one reason for being here did not require socializing. None of these agents were his peers, and they knew it. They all had better training, more experience, and a broader range of skills. The fact Harrison outranked them all, including Coggins, who gave him his orders, did not make working with them easier. From a tiny clip on Harrison's collar, Coggins spoke.
"Cody, you're up."
Harrison cracked his knuckles and headed out to the mansion. Inside the front door stood Carr and Milton. Harrison's entire apartment would have easily fit inside this foyer several times over. He looked up at a dome with numerous skylights. From here, a double-curved staircase led to a second and third floor, both of which looked down on the entrance. With their name badges now visible, Harrison could identify which name went with which gender, as well as which one was the magic specialist. Carr, the woman, wore the purple heptagonal insignia of the Bureau of Esoteric Affairs on her shoulder. She stood no taller than 5 feet, with straight brown hair cropped close enough to expose the points of her ears. Her tan skin had a faintly bark-like quality, noticeable only up close. Probably Dryad. Her true name was almost certainly not Carr, but something that approximately anglicized to it. On her hip, she wore a small satchel, likely containing tools for detecting magic, buttoned closed.
"The site is clean of magic," said Milton, the other agent, clearly human.
Carr gave him a look of consternation.
"Clean?"
He shook his head. "Sorry, devoid. No offense intended."
She
said.
Milton gestured with his arm. "Special Agent Cody, please come with me."
He led Harrison past the stairs, down a narrow corridor, and through a door at the top of a much simpler, straight staircase going down. They descended to an extravagantly finished basement. It contained a set of offices and storage rooms, and Milton directed Harrison into one of these. Coggins stood there next to an open wall panel. Behind the panel sat an exposed vault door of rectangular steel, adorned with both a keypad and a large wheel. On a desk near the Discovery, Coggins had unrolled a collection of heavy-duty cutting tools. None of them had been removed from their pockets.
"No sign of booby traps. I assume these won't be necessary."
Coggins indicated the roll of tools. Wordlessly, Harrison walked over to the vault and placed his right palm on it. It rumbled beneath his hand, as whatever series of tumblers and locks held it in place all surrendered to his simple touch. After 5 seconds or so, the door popped outward with a slight hiss.
"Anything else?"
Coggins laughed.
"There's a locked room on the third floor and a padlock on the pool gate behind the house if you're feeling bored. Otherwise, no, this was the objective."
Harrison stepped aside and allowed Milton to move in and open the door wide. A light came on inside, which promptly reflected off the stack of gold bars resting on a steel table in the center of the chamber. Shelves covered the walls of the vault, nearly all of them empty. The three men stared at the treasure in silence for a few seconds.
"Well, fuck," said Coggins. "May I?" asked Harrison. "Be my guest," said Coggins.
Harrison walked into the vault and carefully picked up one of the bars, easily 20 pounds, and he relished its heft. A year earlier, this would have been a different experience. Coggins spoke into his collar.
Rover 2 to base. House is secure. No evidence of magic or advanced technology.
Roger, Rover 2, came the tinny reply. The vault?
Contents of the vault are...
He paused, scanning the pile of gold bricks, moving his lips slightly.
22 bars of gold bullion.
The voice on the other end paused.
Rover 2, confirm gold bullion.
Coggins sighed.
Roger that. Completely worthless.
Harrison opened the second floor room, which turned out to be a closet full of filing cabinets loaded with long, irrelevant documents. He also popped the lock on the pool gate, but by that point he was wandering on his own. The rest of the team spent the next 2 hours cataloging items of value and loading them into the transport's cargo hold. By the time he regrouped with them out front, they appeared to be nearly finished. They milled about, chatting and showing each other various interesting finds. One agent lit a cigarette, which Carr promptly plucked out of his mouth and crushed in her bare hand. A heated argument ensued, too far away to hear properly. Coggins looked up briefly from a clipboard to observe it, but did not intervene. Harrison made his way to the lead agent.
Agent Coggins, if I may?
Coggins stared at his clipboard.
Yes, Cody? Would it be possible for me to take one of the gold bricks? My son will think it's the coolest thing he's ever seen.
Coggins frowned.
Don't you have two kids?
That this person, whose name Harrison had not even remembered, knew him so well did not surprise him. Odd fame, part of the package of his uniqueness.
Yeah, but Dorothy... Actually, yeah, can I take two? There's room in the cargo hold for them, so I don't see why not.
He looked at his watch.
You have 12 minutes to bring them up here and stow them.
Thank you, said Harrison. Coggins nodded.
Rover 2, said the clip on his collar. Are you still surveying?
He held his hand up, halting Harrison.
Roger, base, finishing inventory right now, departing in 11 minutes.
Negative, Rover 2. Load the gold.
Coggins hesitated.
Base, confirm load the gold.
Roger that. The Arts Council wants to make flutes out of it.
Roger that.
Coggins looked at Harrison.
Well, Cody, it looks like we're both shit out of luck.
It took nearly half an hour to load the gold onto the transport, including deciding which items already stowed would have to be left behind to make room for the weight allowance. Harrison spent this half hour on the sidelines. Nothing about that process involved anyone needing anything to be unlocked, and no one asked for his help with any other part of it. As Coggins finalized the inventory and called roll, a gust of warm air rippled through the palm trees and brushed the transport with enough force to rock it. Harrison looked up at a cloudless sky.
Let's go, people.
Coggins made a whirling gesture of haste. Harrison boarded the transport and found his seat. Outside the window, palm trees swayed visibly. Coggins entered the front hatch and sealed it behind him.
Are we expecting weather?
He asked the driver. The agent behind the wheel scanned readouts on the dash.
No, but that means nothing.
Climate patterns over the previous year had generally been close to what they had been before everything changed, punctuated by occasional, random events neither predictable nor explicable. The probability a calm, late April day in Illinois could produce a violent hailstorm or a tornado was low, but not out of the question. As if to emphasize this, another gust hit the transport, this time hard enough to tip it at least 15 degrees.
Strap in, said Coggins. Let's not dawdle.
The transport backed away from the mansion. Halfway through the 3-point turn that would orient the survey team back toward New Chicago, the house collapsed in full view from the windshield. With a thunderous crash, and in a fraction of a second, a vertical gust drove the entire structure straight to the ground and flattened it, along with several surrounding trees.
What the fuck? Shouted Coggins. Go, go, go!
The driver abandoned the slow turn, and the transport lurched forward into the woods. It handily rolled over thick brush without slowing. Harrison's seatbelt bit into his shoulder several times,
while the driver made a wide, rapid turn that brought them back to the trail they had originally cleared on their way in. At that point, the ride became smoother and swifter. After about half a minute, Coggins asked,
"What's happening?"
"Not sure."
The driver checked some readouts.
"I think it might be over. It looks like nothing but still air for at least a 10-mile radius. If that changes, I'll let you know."
"Just get us home."
Coggins slouched in his seat. The small talk that defined the ride out did not resume on the way back. While the other agents likely contemplated their mortality in the face of natural events they no longer understood, Harrison's thoughts were more focused and dire. Either that destructive wind had been a freak weather event, or the third attempt on his life. Chapter 3. May 30th Stories.
I was shopping. One minute I'm in the mall looking at a shirt. The next I'm standing outside in a bed of gravel that must have been 2 miles wide.
Sarah paused, trying to collect her thoughts. It didn't happen all at once, either. I mean, it was fast, but not, I don't know, instant. At first I got dizzy, and it looked like all the color had gone out of everything, and then the roof dissolved. People were popping like soap bubbles left and right, not even leaving a mark. I remember thinking I should scream, but by the time I got my mouth open, everything was gone.
She paused again and shrugged. My watch stopped, so I have no idea how long I was on that gravel. Long enough to turn my feet into 2 huge blisters, I do know that. Eventually, I found a house. I stayed there until I heard Claudia the first time. She sniffed. God, I haven't thought about that day in so long. What about you guys?
Sarah sat on one of the benches that had been built and earmarked for the city park. The land had all been cleared, and the lawn was coming along nicely, though it had taken more of a beating than expected from the impromptu public fireworks show earlier that week. But most of the benches and playground equipment had yet to be installed. About 30 of these benches awaited their final placements, all lined up on the lot in tidy rows like pews. They were technically not for public use yet, but Harrison and Sarah had more latitude than most city dwellers and frequently spent their off time there. Like Harrison, Sarah enjoyed some benefits as one of New Chicago's 4 resident telekinetics. While his gift granted him only the ability to open locks, hers stocked clocks. These autonomic and as yet unexplained talents had earned them jobs with the NCSA, though in Sarah's case, that position was largely ceremonial. Like the other 2 known telekinetics, Harrison and Sarah had historically significant birth dates. He had been born on July 4th, 1976, the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Sarah's birth date was July 20th, 1969, the date of the first lunar landing. A third telekinetic, Bob Rutherford, preferred to be called Dallas in recognition of his being born on the day of the Kennedy assassination. The fourth, born on the day of the Tiananmen Square massacre, was Claudia de Quiroz. Sarah, her boyfriend Warren, and their friend Hope had joined Harrison and his children, enjoying the mild spring weather and the view. Ever since Alec transferred him to salvage detail, he had seen less of Sarah, and when he did see her, he relished the fact it could be purely social. Sarah looked around invitingly. May 30 Stories had become a cultural phenomenon as the New Chicago community grew, as the residents' one common frame of reference. For some, telling their stories repeatedly to everyone they met offered some measure of catharsis. Others saved their stories and only offered them to their closest companions.
"Hope?" said Sarah. "Where were you?"
Hope laughed.
"I didn't quite sleep through the end of the world, but it wasn't for lack of trying. I was post-call, exhausted, and trying to catch a 10-minute nap between morning rounds and office hours."
She paused, looking off into space with a serene expression on her face.
"I managed a brief but wonderful dream that I'd actually decided to be an English professor instead of a family practice resident before the damn beeper went off again."
She sighed.
"I grabbed the phone, pried my eyes open to look at the number on the beeper and started dialing. There was a roaring sound, like my dream was mad about letting go of me. And then the phone was gone from my hand. So was the bed, the call room, the whole hospital. And I was in a patch of woods lying on a very uncomfortable route, wearing hospital scrubs and no shoes. The damn beeper was still in my left hand, still beeping.
"Still beeping?" said Harrison.
She nodded. No lie, I let it go until the battery ran out. It was my only connection to the old world. I couldn't bring myself to kill it.
Harrison laughed. "That's... wow. I think I would have killed it."
"Anybody else?" said Hope.
"I'll go." Dorothy told the story of her mother and two sisters. She paused occasionally, struggling not to go on, as if by delaying the story she could keep her little sisters that much longer. Harrison had heard this story before. The words and the timing were rehearsed, but the longing, that was always real. Sarah bit her lip as Dorothy ended with the disappearance of her family. No discussion followed of what happened next, no tale of her journey to the Hallmark store or the home she had built for herself there on her own. For her, the story ended with the disappearance of the three people she loved most in the world.
"Oh, honey, come here."
Sarah took the girl in her arms and held her. Harrison had been there many, many times. Though a survivor, this girl would never, for the rest of her life, get enough hugs to smooth over that bump.
"Do you have a story?" Sarah asked Mitchell.
Harrison stayed back to see how the boy would play this, ready to jump in if he needed saving. Mitchell usually got quiet when people talked about May 30 around him.
He shrugged.
"I was playing outside."
"He was alone," Harrison said. "He didn't really see anything happen. Right, sport?"
Harrison still did not know the full details of Mitchell's experience. Watching these kids play, he sometimes found it easy to forget what they all had been through. Hundreds of children in New Chicago all had stories to tell about how they had lost their parents. It was a miracle they could function at all, and yet they had all come through, adjusting in their own ways. An assertive and emotionally stable boy most of the time, Mitchell would sometimes slip out of character, and Harrison would see him as the poster child for post-traumatic stress disorder. He wished he could be a better parent when those moments came, but he managed as well as he could. Apropos of nothing, Dorothy slapped Mitchell's arm, hard enough to make a sound. It snapped him out of whatever catatonia he was sliding into, and he gave her a shocked look.
"You're it?"
Deadpan, she bolted.
"Ah!"
He leapt off the bench, fell down on the wet grass, and pulled himself up to run after her. Dorothy had a sizable head start, and she made it into a grove of trees well before he could catch her.
"She'll be dodging him in there for a good 15 minutes before she lets him catch her," Harrison said to the other adults. "He would have had a fighting chance on open ground, but she's a real squirrel when she gets into the trees."
"She's amazing," said Sarah. Harrison shook his head.
"They both are. Mitchell came here with me on foot the whole way from Milwaukee after we survived a train crash together. Dorothy joined us not much farther south than that. Both of them had been living on their own for months when I found them. It's incredible to me they can go back to being kids."
"They're lucky you found them," she said. He shrugged.
"We were all lucky, I think."
At that moment, a pronounced chirping sound emanated from Hope's belt. She plucked a small black object from it and killed the sound.
"Oh, wow," said Harrison. "Is that the beeper?"
"It is the beeper." Hope stood. "Couldn't throw it away, could I? Have to run, folks."
To Sarah, she said, "I will see you Tuesday morning."
"Yes, doctor," said Sarah, smiling.
"Take care,"
said Hope, departing.
"Hey," Sarah looked around. "Where's Glimmer? I thought she was your sidekick."
Harrison laughed. "I'm hers, more like. She had a..."
He twirled his hand in a gesture of vagueness. "A thing down at Esoteric. They needed her input on something I can't even pronounce.
How's her hand? Asked Warren.
Beats me, said Harrison.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?